what's fascinating about this particular pyramid is it had a chapel on the front of it. And in this chapel, they found the smashed remains of a statue. It's a very unusual statue. It's not Egyptian this time. So he had flame red hair, yellow skin, and he carried a throw stick, which is a symbol of a foreigner, a Semite, on his shoulder. And then when we look at the back of the statue, we have remains of paint there of stripes. This is a coat made of multicolored stripes. It's a coat of many colors.
5 centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the White Horse Inn. I'm Shane Rosenthal. Last week on the program, we heard from Dr. John Lennox, who argued that the account we find in the latter part of Genesis, in which Joseph publicly forgives his brothers for their betrayal, is, quote, one of the most moving scenes in all the world's literature. But is the story of Joseph just a beautiful rags-to-riches tale, or is there any evidence that this narrative is actually based on real historical events? My guest for this program is Dr. David Roll, who is a maverick Egyptologist and the author of numerous books, including Pharaohs and Kings, A Test of Time, and Exodus Myth or History. Several years ago, the archaeology correspondent for the popular British newspaper, The Daily Mail, noted that David Roll's books have convinced me that he is one of the most brilliant and original minds now engaged in writing ancient history, end quote. His books have been published in many parts of the world and have been translated in over 12 languages. Dr. Roll's been on the program before to discuss his unique view of Egyptian chronology and the implications that his research has on our understanding of biblical events, such as the Israelite exodus from Egypt. And on this program, I've invited him back to discuss the search for the historical Joseph. Dr. Roll, thanks for being my guest again on the White Horse Inn.
Nice to be back.
So when we had you on the program last time, we spent most of our time discussing your alternative chronology along with the evidence for the Exodus. And so if our listeners are interested in that program, I've put a link to it in our show notes section for this episode. But on this program, I'd like us to focus on the events related to the Bible's account of the life of Joseph. So why don't you first start out by reminding our listeners about the discoveries made by Manfred Bitek and his team at Tel Adaba?
Sure. Well, Tel Adaba is ancient Avaris. That's the name that the site was given in ancient times. Tel Adaba is a small village, which is where the actual site is located today. And Bitek was excavating there from the 1960s. So he was excavating for a good 30 or 40 years. And he came across a mound, or a tell, as we call it in the ancient world, which contained a village, a small village, which began life with probably no more than about a dozen houses, mud brick houses in this place that had not been occupied for at least 100 years before that. The site is actually right next to what was the ancient Pelusiac branch of the River Nile. That area was called the land of Goshen in the Bible, and that's been demonstrated today because we actually have that name found now in that area. It's a topographic feature of that area. So we know that is the land of Goshen of the Bible.
Where was that found?
It was found actually in the Wadi Chumalat on the western end, and it's actually a mention of a lake called the Lake of Gesem. Hmm. So it shows us that that area is biblical Goshen, Septuagint Gesem. Now, the thing is that when the life began at that place was at the end of the 12th dynasty, when a small village was formed for the first time there. It probably no more than about a dozen, maybe 15 houses, at the center of which was a very special house, what the Austrians call a middle room house, which is typical of the type of architecture we get in northern Mesopotamia, the area around Haran, Orpha, that region where we know that Abraham came from. So it's a typical house of the period of the Middle Bronze Age that we find up there, and it's built down in Egypt in the Eastern Delta in the land of Goshen. And about probably a population of between 70 or 100 people lived in that village at its beginnings. It eventually grew into a massive city, one of the biggest cities in the ancient world, which is called Avaris by the Egyptians. So we know that we have this population coming in here from the northwest Syria, Mesopotamia, coming down into Egypt, settling there in the land of Goshen and building houses typical of the region they've come from, which sounds remarkable like the story in the book of Genesis of the arrival of Jacob, for example.
What evidence other than the style of the house do we have that this is a community of Semites?
We have their graves. And those graves show us that they are Canaanite. Their pottery is Canaanite that we find there. It's not Egyptian. The way they're buried, they're laid on their side. They're not laid on their backs like Egyptians would be, in a semi-fetal position, which is very typical of Canaanite burials. Some of the chieftain figures who were buried at this site over a period of maybe a couple of hundred years, they were buried with slain donkeys in a pit in front of their tombs, plus a couple of sheep. Now, when the sheep were analyzed, they were found to be North Syrian type of sheep, which are typical of the area, again, from Haran. So they brought their sheep with them down from the north into Egypt. And these are the first sheep we find in Egypt. We don't find the Egyptians normally having flocks of sheep. These are the first ones to appear in Egypt. So we know they are what we call Western Asiatics. That's the term that archaeology uses. This is the first time we see a large population of Western Asiatics or Semites in Egypt in the Middle Bronze Age.
So real briefly, why is it that this sort of information doesn't even get a mention in conservative Bible commentaries or even archaeological study Bibles?
Wrong time. Simple as that.
Yeah.
You know, we have a situation where everybody expects these stories in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, to occur a lot later in history, in Egyptian history. And this is a problem with the Egyptian chronology, which we talked about previously.
Yeah.
So we're looking at moving the Egyptian timeline, which brings the patriarchs down in time relative to the Egyptian chronology. And we find ourselves at the end of the 12th dynasty, the Middle Kingdom, where we find these people appearing in Egypt for the first time with their Syrian style houses, with their Syrian sheep. And that's the time I would place Joseph and Jacob.
Now, later on the site of that initial four-room house, you point out that a great palace was later constructed. Talk about that.
Yes. Well, if we take the story on a little bit, we know the story is all about the great famine that occurs in Egypt in this particular period, the time of Jacob's arrival in Egypt. He comes into Egypt in the second year of the famine. And of course, the person who he's come to see there is Joseph, who is now the great leader of the country, second only to the Pharaoh. And he's the one building the granaries and preparing for this famine, storing the grain, taking the fields and the land from the rich nobles, putting into government hands. Very typical of what we find in the story in the book of Genesis. This is all happening at this time.
Hmm.
We do have a big famine at this time. So obviously the story finishes when the famine finishes. The last thing we hear about in Joseph is when he's on his deathbed. What happens in between the famine and his deathbed is Joseph being the vizier or the leader in the land, the administrator in the land. And of course, he's going to get a palace built for him. He's not going to live in a hovel. Pharaoh is going to build him a grand palace. And that is what we find immediately on top of this Syrian house, which is Jacob's house, I believe. When Jacob dies, the house is demolished and a palace is built on top of it. And I think this is the palace of Joseph. It's an Egyptian-style palace, but the occupant was not Egyptian. We know that from the graves that surround the palace. We know that from the tomb of the owner of the palace, that he was a Western Asiatic, a Semite. So although it's an Egyptian high official, the person was a foreigner. He was not Egyptian.
And you say that his tomb was actually in the shape of a large pyramid. Do we have any other pyramid tombs for anyone other than the pharaohs?
Not at this time, no. Much later in the New Kingdom we do. We have pyramid-shaped tombs. It's not a massive pyramid. It's not like the great pyramids of the Old Kingdom and Middle Kingdom, the stone ones. This is a mud brick pyramid. And the actual burial is underneath the pyramid. It's not inside the pyramid. It's below the pyramid. But what's fascinating about this particular pyramid is it had a chapel on the front of it. Now, that's not normal. And in this chapel, they found the smashed remains of a statue, which has been reconstructed. Now, that statue is fascinating because of what it looks like. It's a very unusual statue. It's not Egyptian this time. It's an Egyptian-style statue, but the person himself is not Egyptian.
And it's a large statue, right? How big would you say it is?
It's twice life size, but because it's a seated figure, it doesn't go to twice your normal standing height. It will be about a third higher than your normal standing height.
Yeah. So obviously, this pyramid tomb seems to be representing a notable Egyptian official, and yet you say that the hairstyle and the skin tone revealed that he was a foreigner.
And the coat that he's wearing as well, because we have remains of paint on the statue. Now, what remains of the statue is just basically the head and the shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of it has been smashed and taken away. The statue was very badly damaged. It was actually attacked with an axe, so the head is partially smashed. The front of the face is smashed off. The body of the actual statue was carted off and used somewhere else. We've never found it. It's been used in a building somewhere else, in a mosque or something in the Islamic period. Who knows where it is? But what we have left is this head. and the shoulders. Now, one of the things about the shoulders is that he has a scepter of office across his left shoulder, which is actually a throw stick. And a throw stick is the sign the Egyptians use for a foreigner from Canaan, a Canaanite. It's a throw stick is a symbol of hunting with the throw stick, like a boomerang. And it's always used in Egyptian hieroglyphs to represent a foreigner, or what they call Amu, which means Asiatic or somebody from the north. So we have already a symbol there that shows that this guy is not Egyptian. He's a foreigner. When we look at his skin color, what the remains of the paint we have over the on the forehead is yellow. He's not dark skin, brown, like you would expect an Egyptian to be. He's actually pale yellow skinned. And we have the remains of fragments of paint to show that. And his hair is remarkable. It's mushroom shaped. And the remains of the paint there are flame red. So he had flame red hair, yellow skin, and he carried a throw stick, which is a symbol of a foreigner, a Semite, on his shoulder. And then when we look at the back of the statue on the shoulders, we have remains of paint there of stripes. And those stripes are in possibly red, black, and white, the colors that we typically see for Asiatics of the Middle Bronze Age period. They have multicolored coats, and this guy was wearing a multicolored coat.
Were Egyptians ever depicted wearing multicolored coats?
No, not like these at all. The Egyptians tended to wear white with trim on their sleeves and on around their necks. This is a coat made of multicolored stripes. It's a coat of many colors.
But you do point out that there is a cave discovered. I think it's called the Beni Hassan Cave, which depicts Canaanites wearing multicolored coats. Talk about that.
Yeah, sure. This is a tomb of one of the nomarchs or local leaders, regional leaders, who were very powerful at this time, depicting the arrival of Asiatics in Egypt, almost like the story of the Midianites bringing Joseph into Egypt. What we find there is we have a train of foreigners, Asiatics, coming into Egypt, selling eye color, basically, you know, kohl. And they're coming in, there's 37 of them, and the men are all wearing multicolored coats. The chieftain figure who's leading them has a very, very elaborate multicolored coat. And this is the only time in Egyptian history where we have depictions in the art of this type of multicolored coat that foreigners are wearing. It doesn't happen later and it doesn't happen earlier. But it is one generation before the time I would place Joseph.
Which would basically indicate that at the very time that's reported in Genesis, the kind of amazing technicolor dream coat just so happens to be,
yes,
according to the archaeology of the period, the kind of garment that was in style among the Canaanites and exclusively among the Canaanites.
Exactly. And it was prestigious. The grander the coat, the more prestigious the individual. So when this special coat was given to Joseph by Jacob, the rest of his brothers get jealous because this was a fabulous one, like the chieftain we find in this nomarch's tomb, as opposed to the rest of the men who are following him behind. They've got less elaborate coats, less ornate coats. So it's a status symbol, and that is why the brothers were so jealous of it.
So this particular colossal statue, you know, as you point out, has numerous indications that it's a foreign ruling official.
Yes.
Are there any other viziers or prime ministers, governors, which we've discovered that are shown to be foreigners holding that important office?
Well, we know that when this village is founded at Avaris, it's only after that we start to see high officials with Semitic names. So this village is formed at the end of the 12th dynasty. We would put Jacob and Joseph in that period there. But of course, Joseph continued after Jacob dies to rule in Egypt as the vizier for a long period of time. So that takes us well into the 13th dynasty. And we start to see at the time when he is in power, we start to see Semitic pharaohs and Semitic high officials running the country. And the Egyptian, native Egyptians, are less powerful in this period.
Now, when Manfred Bitek and his team excavated the burial chamber of that pyramid tomb, they discovered that a hole had been dug into it and its contents removed. Why do you think that's significant?
Well, think of the story. When the Exodus takes place, Moses has to remove the body of Joseph to fulfill the promise that Joseph should be taken to the promised land when the Exodus occurs. So the Israelites had to remove the body from his tomb. So here we have this pyramid tomb with a grand palace right next to the river, and we have a hole dug from the chapel where the smashed statue was located down into the tomb beneath the pyramid. And when the archaeologists actually excavated the burial chamber itself, they found no remains of any body, no bones. The actual burial chamber floor was completely clean. There's no pottery, there's no beads, there's no anything that you would expect to find from a tomb or a burial. The question is, of course, if this was tomb robbery, if somebody had come along and decided to rob the tomb, why would they take the bones out of it? The bones are of no value at all. So what we have is a cleaned out tomb. The body's disappeared. The coffin in which it was contained has disappeared. And then afterwards, somebody comes along and smashes this statue to smithereens. Now, I'm saying this is the Egyptians coming to take revenge on the person who brought these Asiatics, these Semites, into Egypt in the first place, and has caused this disaster we call the Exodus with all the plagues.
Is there any way to tell approximately when that hole was dug?
Impossible. What we do know is that it was covered over by the later strata, so the Hyksos period is above that. So it must have occurred before the Hyksos arrived.
Okay.
So we're talking about after the 13th dynasty, yeah. Yes? So we would place the Exodus sometime in the late 13th dynasty, then the arrival of the Hyksos after that. The pyramid itself was demolished, so that would all the debris from that would have been piled on top of this original tunnel that was dug, covering over the statue, covering over the chapel, and then more graves were placed above it, which then interloped, if you like, bits and remains of them into the upper part of the original level where the tomb was located.
I think in your book, you indicated that the colossal statue was facing east toward the Promised Land.
It's northeast, yes.
Okay.
So it's even better, actually. It's not directly east into Sinai.
Yeah.
Yes. But that's probably not that important. Orientation of tombs is quite a difficult subject because it tends to be the way that the head is facing, direction the head is facing, huh, as opposed to where the tomb is facing.
Talk for a minute, if you would, about some of the other prominent tombs found in this area of the great palace there at Avaris.
Absolutely. Well, this palace had a garden in the back. And over a period of time, there are 12 major tombs constructed in that garden, one of which is the pyramid tomb, which we would assign to Joseph. Now, the others may well be the tribal chieftains, the other brothers of Joseph. It's a possibility. Intriguingly, there's one joint double tomb from separate periods. They're not all buried together. And it's a joint tomb. And of course, there are two famous brothers of Joseph, the ones who killed all the people in Shechem, you know, Levi, and I can't remember who the other one was, but they are described as having very sharp weapons. And what was found in the tomb? Beautiful bronze daggers with ivory handles and gold pommels and beautiful riveted bronze weapons, which are typical of the sort of period we're talking about. So these guys were very much associated with the weaponry that they had in their possession when they were alive.
Now, according to Genesis 41:45, Pharaoh gave Joseph the Egyptian name Zaphnath-Paneah, which in the original Hebrew was probably closer to Zaphnath-Paneah.
That's correct.
So do we have any evidence for an Egyptian vizier by that name in any texts or inscriptions outside of the Bible?
Okay, so what the first thing I have to do is separate those two names. Zaphnath is actually a corrupted version of Egyptian Zatenath, which means he who is called. And what we find is Egyptian papyri at this time, when they have slave lists, they have a Semitic name, and then he who is called and their Egyptian name. So they're given, these Semites are given an Egyptian name. So this he who is called is Zatenath. Okay, so the first part simply means he who is called. Now, Anea is the actual pronunciation of what we call Ankh today, the sign of life, the symbol of life. The modern Egyptologists call it Ankh, but actually it was pronounced Anech. So right. Pa-Aneach would mean the one who lives. So remember the story of Joseph and Jacob coming into Egypt and finding that his son, who he'd thought been killed by a beast in the fields, was still alive and was the great high official of Egypt. So Pharaoh, what does he do? He gives Joseph a very, very nice Egyptian name. He was called the one who lives.
So basically, in Egyptian, his name would be sort of close to the way J.K. Rowling first described Harry Potter as the boy who lived.
Yes, exactly correct. What a good parallel that is. Very good. Excellent. I like that. So it's not difficult to understand that Zaphnath and Zatenath are the same. You've got a metathesis there of the P or the F and the T. They swapped around. We have that all the time in ancient languages, especially with foreign languages transferred into another language. So in the Bible, for instance, we have quite a good few examples of that. So once you've got he who is called, if we look at the name Aneach, that actually is an Egyptian, modern Egyptian parlance, how we would pronounce it today, would be Anku. That's how we modern, but Aneachu or Aneach would be the way it was really pronounced. Now, Anku was the greatest vizier of the 13th dynasty, late 12th dynasty, 13th dynasty. The granary stores all over Egypt are called the granary stores of Anku.
Wow.
So that again matches the story of Joseph, because he was the one who built the grain stores in the time before the famine. So they're named after him. Many of the slave lists have names, named children named after Anku. So they're actually called Anku this or Anku that. So he was a very, very powerful vizier of the time. And we reckon that he is the guy who was the Egyptian version of the biblical Joseph. In other words, he'd been given his Egyptian name, and he's referred to in the Egyptian text by his Egyptian name, not by his Hebrew name.
Do we have any records of Anku that links us to any other elements of the Joseph story? For example, Joseph was married to an Asenath. Do we know the name of Anku's wife? Anything about his children?
Unfortunately, we don't know anything about his wife, and you wouldn't expect an Egyptian text. You know, when you have these official documents, they don't say, and the missus was called so-and-so. So it would be difficult to find things like that. Sometimes we do find it when we have a genealogy, perhaps, of a son who would name his mother and father. But in this case, we don't have that. But what we do know is that Anku was followed by a vizier whose name is very similar to Ephraim. And it, as you know from the story, Ephraim is chosen to be the senior, although he's the younger son. He's shown to be the senior one. So it's very possible that this vizier who follows him actually took the job that Joseph had. Once Joseph had died, his son took over. And that would be quite normal in Egyptian society for that to happen. So it is very possible that we have a situation where one of Joseph's sons did continue to be vizier. And this is in the period before all the sons had died. Remember, the story is that the pharaoh who did not know Joseph comes along with his little dynasty and decides to oppress the Israelites.
And you say the palace was later expanded to include two bedroom units that sort of matches the family situation there with the two sons.
Yeah, I can see you've read that book very carefully. Very good. Yes, in fact, the original House of Joseph, if you like, had a facade with 12 columns on, which we think of the 12 tribes. In front of that, they constructed two identical apartments that were a mirror to each other. So they're identical. So why? It's very unusual to find that in architecture anywhere. So if there were two sons of Joseph and there were two sons of the guy who occupied this palace, he built two apartments for his two sons. And what that did was it resulted in enclosing the original palace area with a courtyard. So the two apartments were in front of the palace and formed a courtyard between them. So there were side walls and two. So that's how it worked. And what's fascinating is that the palace part, the older part of the palace, was eventually bricked up and sealed. Nobody was allowed to go in it. And that is typical of when a person who owns the palace dies. Nobody else is allowed to live in that palace once the owner dies. And so this one was completely sealed up and left intact, sealed. And then they built another palace next to it, which was a successor to that palace for the next vizier who came along. And that we would think would be Ephraim.
In his book, The World's Oldest Alphabet, Douglas Petrovich makes the argument that there's a reference to a person named Asenath in Sinai inscription 376, and that another inscription may refer to Hebrews of Bethel. What are your thoughts about his work?
Okay, this is quite a complex subject area. We're talking about the earliest alphabet invented by humankind. Egyptologists call it Proto-Sinaitic, but it is in fact the first time that anybody in the world uses symbols to create letters to form words. So you construct a word using an alphabet, as opposed to hieroglyphs, which aren't like that. There are many more hieroglyphic signs than the Proto-Sinaitic signs, which are probably about 23 or 26 altogether. So very similar to our own alphabet today. We do agree on when this invention happened. The person who came up with this was during the reign of a king called Amenemhat III, who was one of the last kings of the 12th dynasty. Now, he is the pharaoh of Joseph in my chronology. He's not the pharaoh of Joseph in Dog's chronology. I think he moves him back to Senusrat III, who was the father of Amenemhat III. However, those two kings actually had a co-regency of 20 years, so they overlapped. Senusrat III introduced his son to the throne 20 years before he died himself. So there's a long overlap between the two of them. So we might be talking about the same period, in fact, where this invention takes place. Now, I would accredit Joseph to that post because he was an educated Semite. he was an official administering the land, he would need to send instructions to all the people he was sending out to work the fields, to gather in the grain, to go to the mines in Sinai to bring back copper and also turquoise. He'd have to write notes and messages. He would have to find a way to do that. And so we think he's the best candidate for the inventor of the first human alphabet. So we have a period when we know the alphabet began life, but it then continued all the way through what we would call the 13th dynasty, the period after the 12th dynasty. And then it would probably move across to what we call Proto-Canaanite, which is where we find it in Canaan, in the land of Canaan. Now, in the revised chronology, this would be the time when the Israelites have moved into the promised land. Mm-hmm. So they would bring this alphabetic script with them. So it's actually not Proto-Canaanite at all. It's Proto-Hebrew. Okay, and then it evolves into what we would call Paleo-Hebrew, the later form. And they would then give it in the time of Solomon to the Phoenicians. Not that the Hebrews borrowed it from the Phoenicians. They gave it to Hiram of Tyre, and then the Phoenicians gave it to the Greeks.
Yeah.
And the Greeks gave it to the Romans, and the Romans gave it to us. It's the same alphabet.
Which is why in Hebrew it's Aleph Bet, and in Greek it's Alpha Beta, and we talk about the alphabet.
Absolutely, absolutely. The signs are, you could derive the modern signs through the Greek, through the Phoenician, back to this Proto-Sinaitic. The shapes evolve, but you can identify those shapes in the earliest Proto-Sinaitic inscriptions.
So you agree with Petrovich that Hebrew is the world's oldest alphabet. You just disagree with his translations of some of those inscriptions?
The translations and also the timing as well, because he tends to divide them sharply between the time of Joseph and the time of Moses. And so when he's looking at the Proto-Sinaitic inscriptions in Sinai, he's placing them all in the time of Exodus, the time of Moses. Now, that is possible, but we have inscriptions earlier than that in the Wadi El Hol, which are from the time of Joseph, and they translate in a way that makes them sound like they are criticisms of Joseph by some disgruntled official or laborer, whatever he is, who's able to scratch an inscription, and he's moaning about this guy all dressed in his finery. I can actually give you a translation if you want it.
Sure.
I've got it on my computer here. And you have to think of it now as being Joseph, okay? This is somebody writing about Joseph. It is too much for us. The taskmaster even conscripts the free man. Now, as you know from the story, Joseph actually forced free men to work in the fields as well as the slaves. The nobles of Egypt were brought to actually gather in the grain and produce the grain for people. So that is a really telling inscription. It's somebody moaning about the fact that the taskmaster, i.e. Joseph, is conscripting even free men to gather in the grain.
And you're translating that, assuming that these characters are actually Paleo-Hebrew?
These characters are Paleo-Hebrew. The Wadi El Hol inscriptions are the very first evidence we have for this particular alphabet.
But you don't believe that Petrovich is right when he says he finds in some of these inscriptions references to Joseph's wife, Asenath, or Hebrews of Bethel.
We don't see that. What I did was I went into Sinai and I actually found many of these inscriptions that originally found by Petrie in 1905. And we checked them, and I contacted a rabbi in Israel who is a specialist in biblical Hebrew, as most Orthodox Jews are. They are very familiar with the inscriptions, and they know their Paleo-Hebrew, etc. And he's an expert on this. And I said, I'm going to give you a set of Proto-Sinaitic letters, and I'm going to give you the English anglicized versions of those letters. I want you to read them, and I want you to tell me what you think they are. And he wrote back to me and said, this is pure biblical Hebrew. I read it instantly. I didn't have any problem in reading it whatsoever. The reason why most conventional scholars say it can't be biblical Hebrew, of course, is this is way before Moses. This is way before Joseph,
right,
in the conventional dating scheme. So it can't be Hebrew for them, basically. But when we remove that problem of the timeline and we place Joseph and Moses in the 12th and 13th dynasties, this fits perfectly with that. And so when we move then on to the Sinai inscriptions, not the Wadi El Hol ones, but the ones in Sinai at Serabit El Kadim. Now, where Doug, for me, has a problem is he finds the name Moses in there. But what he looks for is just two letters, M and S. It's okay, so Moshe, Mos, Mes. That's all he finds. And that can be actually many, many different words with a letter added to that, three letters rather than two. So I don't think his translations are actually correct. The one he has about Joseph's wife, Asenath, it's a tortured translation. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. One of the most important things of translating any language is that the sentence must make sense, and it has to have a context. When we look at Rabbi Michael Shlomo Baron's translations, the guy that I asked to look at these inscriptions, this Hebrew scholar, and he's very well versed in ancient biblical Hebrew. His translations are so much more dynamic, so much more related to the biblical story of Exodus. They are going to be in my next book, and he's published papers on this now, but they are much more related to the story of Exodus. They talk about the problems that the Israelites and the Hebrews had in worshipping old gods. Hmm. The inscriptions talk about rejecting Baalat, the lady, which is the Semitic version of Hathor. And of course, she is the golden calf.
Right.
So you have these rejections of this worship of this goddess, and you must not talk and you must not speak her name. You must not worship this animal god. And then, of course, later on, you get to Jeroboam the First, who actually says that it was the cow goddess who actually brought the Israelites out of Egypt. It wasn't Yah or Yahweh, it was this cow goddess. So he's reverting back to these other worshippers who thought that Hathor, the goddess of Sinai, was the one who brought them out of Egypt.
Yeah, I can't wait to pick your brain about all this whenever your new book comes out.
Yes.
Back to the Joseph story. According to Genesis 41:45, Potipherah, Joseph's father-in-law, was a priest of On. Are there any external references to priests of On?
Well, On, of course, is Ayuno in the Egyptians or Heliopolis in the Greek. And that was a very, very important city, the city of the sun god,
okay.
Ra. So, yes. So if we were referring to Heliopolis, that would be the Greek version of the name. On is very close to the Egyptian Ayuno, which is the Egyptian version of the name. So we think it was Heliopolis where this priest would have been. And there would have been a huge priesthood for the worship of Ra, the sun god, in Heliopolis.
You say that there's an aspect of Pharaoh's dream that many have overlooked, namely that the seven fat cows and seven thin cows come out of the Nile River. Why do you think that's significant?
The Bible doesn't tell us what caused the famine, does it? And so we have to look at those words there. And what we have is that the fat first and the lean come out of the Nile. Why? Why are they coming out of the Nile? Because it's a metaphor for the cause of both the plenty and the famine. Hmm. The Nile is the mechanism for both. In the first part, the Nile raises higher and its richer silk comes to Egypt for a period of a few years. They've been able to grow crops, expand further into the desert because there's more water. But then we get the catastrophic rise of the River Nile, which destroys everything, which is the period of the famine. So it's all coming from the Nile. And that is hinted at this story where the fat cows come out, they munch on the sides of the riverbank, the lean cows come out and they devour the fat cow. They devour the plenty. So it's all coming out of the Nile. The Nile is the cause of the famine and the plenty.
Earlier, you mentioned that the Pharaoh who elevated Joseph to power in your chronology was Amenemhat III. What do we know about him from history?
Well, he's a very interesting character, actually. He came to the throne very young. His father, as I say, made him a co-regent. So he's actually, for his first 20 years of the reign, he was with his father on the throne. We quite often have co-regencies in this period. And it's about his year 20 or 21 that his father dies, and that is when the famine begins. So the years of plenty are prior to the time when his father dies. And when his father dies, he is then the sole ruler, and it's Joseph who is administering the land, keeping the people alive during the famine period. And it's in his reign that we'd have evidence of this terrible famine, because way down south in the upper reaches of the Nile, there is a narrowing in the Nile between two fortresses, Semna and Kuma. And on the cliff face next to the Nile are heights of the River Nile marked on the point where the water reached during this particular period for each year of this King Amenemhat's reign. And first of all, they are higher than normal. And then within a period of about 7 to 8 years, they suddenly leap up even higher still to a disastrous level, which would have caused total destruction in Egypt, because the flood would then flowed right the way down into Egypt, flooded the land, washed away all the mud brick houses, killed the cattle, but most of all, drowned the fields for such a long period of time that nobody could have planted any crops in that time when they would normally plant, because the land was still flooded, which would result in year after year of no crops, and that would result in famine. And that happened about year 20 of Amenemhat III.
How would that account for the famine in the land of Canaan, which forces Jacob's family to, you know, look for food?
That is a really interesting and very good question. What we're talking about in modern terms is a shift in the climate zones. Okay, so we have a shift northwards, right? So the tropical zone of the Congo region, the equator region, would move up into Ethiopia. And so you would get far more rain in the Ethiopian highlands that you would normally get. that rain would pour down into the Nile Valley, the Blue Nile and the White Nile, come together and flood Egypt to the north. So the result is excess water creates a famine in Egypt because they can't plant the crops. But the Egyptian climate and the Arabian climate is shifting into Canaan, pushed upwards. And that is a dry climate, Sahara desert climate. So your result in Canaan is lack of water, no rain. Huh. So you have that parallel there. You have a drought in the north and you have excess water in the south, which means that the grain can't be grown in Egypt, but the grain can't be grown up in Canaan because there's no rain.
Genesis 37:28 says that Joseph was sold into slavery for 20 shekels of silver. And according to James Hoffmeyer, that actually was the going rate for a slave around the time Joseph would have been alive. But due to inflation, the price increases sometime after that. Is that something you can confirm as well?
Yes, that's true. Kenneth Kitchen was the one who came up with this evidence. Although it's true to say that the 20 shekels would be at a particular time in Egyptian history, it goes back earlier. It actually occurs earlier too. So it actually falls in this period we're talking about, the end of the 12th dynasty. That price would be the correct price. Kitchen has identified that correctly. If we move much further into the timeline, into the New Kingdom and later, the price is more.
Dr. Roll, you've been working on another book project that you mentioned earlier that will soon be released. Can you give our listeners a preview of coming attractions? What's the main thesis of your book? What are you covering?
Okay, well, it was obvious that I had to continue the story from the sojourn, the Exodus, and the conquest, because one of the criticisms I've received is people admit that what we've argued in Exodus, Myth, or History, that particular book, which went with the Patterns of Evidence movies, that all seems to fit quite well. But then they say, oh, well, it can't fit for the rest of Egyptian history. It can't possibly fit there. So I had the job of saying, okay, yes, it can. We can move this whole storyline through now into the Judges period, into the United Monarchy period, into the Divided Monarchy period, all the way down to the fall of the temple by the Babylonians. So that's the job of this next book. In fact, it's two volumes. Hmm. The first volume goes all the way up to the reign of Saul, and then it stops, and the second one continues from David onwards. And it shows how everything fits beautifully with this revised timeline. It doesn't just fit in the Exodus period. It fits all the way through Israelite history. So it's got a lot of information about the reigns of Solomon and David and the Judges. All those things are in there, including astronomical evidence that shows that the longest day, for instance, Joshua's longest day, actually is a physical phenomenon that we can find using astronomical programs.
Wow.
That lasted all day long, practically, at the very time in 1406 BC that we have Joshua coming in and fighting the Battle of Gibeon.
What's a tentative title for your new two-volume work?
It's called Legendary Kings, The Real Bible Unearthed, which is a bit of a dig at Israel Finkelstein, who wrote the book The Bible Unearthed, where there was nothing about the Bible in it.
Well, be sure to let me know when it's finally released so I can have you on to talk about it. And thanks so much for taking the time to be with me for this episode of The White Horse Inn.
It's been great fun. Nice to be with you again.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about this program, visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. If you sign up as an innkeeper, architect, or reformer, not only will you get a complimentary subscription to our magazine, Modern Reformation, but you'll also get longer editions of every White Horse Inn broadcast. To find out how to join one of these support programs, click on the support tab of our website, whitehorseinn.org. You can also give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. We'll see you next time at the White Horse Inn.